Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This series focuses on the integration of new research findings into the day-to-day management of this disease. And for this program, I caught up with a number of investigators at the 2008 Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium in Orlando, aka ASCO GI. To begin, and for a bit of a change of pace, I asked clinical investigators Drs. Axel Grothy, Neil Maripol, and Alan Vanuk to meet with me and present de-identified cases from their practices that made important education points. Dr. Maripol began by presenting a young woman with cancer recurrence after adjuvant therapy.
I was asked to evaluate a 42-year-old woman who had newly diagnosed colon cancer that had already spread to her liver and was unresectable for cure at that point from the standpoint of metastatic disease. And she came to me for a discussion of treatment options. This person had colon cancer that was resected a couple of years earlier. She'd already received FOLFOX as adjuvant therapy, didn't have any substantial long-term toxicity from that, but had some experience with chemotherapy and had been treated by someone else and came to me at this point when her disease had recurred for another opinion about what to do.
Where was the disease?
So the disease was confined to liver. There were multiple hepatic metastases that, because of anatomic factors, could not be resected at this point in time. But there was potential that if she had a great response that she could maybe go on to resection.
And what was her sort of lifestyle, family situation?
So a couple of young children, married, professional, and
spouse.
So was with her spouse.
And any symptoms on the tumor?
She was asymptomatic.
What was her state of mind and her spouse's state of mind?
They were freaked out, as you might imagine, because they were being told that all of their plans for the future were sort of thrown into turmoil, and she thought she was done worrying about this, having had her initial disease resected 2 years earlier, and she thought her worry could be more episodic before the three-month visit for her CEA test and her surveillance.
Axel, last week we had a breast cancer think tank, and I asked Antonio Wolf from Hopkins to present a patient, and it was a young woman who recurred soon after adjuvant chemo. And we were talking about sort of that situation from a psychosocial perspective, not just on the family, but also on the staff and the doctor. How do you think through this situation? What's the spectrum of what you deal with in this situation from a psychosocial point of view?
From a personal perspective, my personal perspective as a treating oncologist, the challenges really you encounter in a day's work, day's routine, so many different facets of what's happening in oncology. You go from a patient who's, let's say, 5 years out after adjuvant therapy, you say this is your last visit and you're hopefully cured, to someone who is first encountered with the diagnosis of non-curable situation in a family situation where young kids are involved. You sympathize with these patients because, I mean, I personally have two young children, and I personally definitely I would be very affected and devastated if I was in this situation. So I think the key issue that I find very helpful and very important for patients is how embedded they are in their social environment. I mean, family support, friend support, whatever. It makes a difference even in how comfortable they are to go about, you know, translating our treatment recommendations into actual action. And so patients who are embedded in a social context which is helpful, which is giving them some hold in this decision, I think is very crucial.
Alan, one of the things that came up with Antonio's case was the issue of minor children in these kinds of situations. How do you deal with that? And is that something that you sort of evaluate as part of these situations?
Well, you have to. And I was going to present a case similar. The young mother who is dealing with this, very frequently their first concern, young mother or father, is their children. And we actually are very aggressive in recommending counseling and trying to demystify it at the same time, not scaring kids. And of course, where I practice in San Francisco, there's great cultural variability. And different cultures will look at this incredibly differently. There are some cultures that won't tell the children, which tortures me, because with teenagers, to me, this is, you know, how do you not tell your children? You know, that's one issue, and I find that you can never take that off the table, but if you can we have sort of people who are particularly interested in children in trauma, will actually often have a meeting that very day to try to get the ball rolling.
What do you think this woman's expectation or hopes were for treatment? Do you think they were realistic? Was she depressed? What was her understanding level where she was at?
I mean, I think she had a pretty good understanding of what the prognosis and what their realities were. You know, there's the frequency estimate for the population that a patient may understand, but when they're thinking about what's going to happen to them, it becomes more of a belief type estimate. Okay, only 10% of the population might survive this, but I'm going to be one of the 10.
And did you get that from her?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's,
hopes that maybe,
I think that's very common.
I cite that I took care of a rabbi years ago, very wise old guy, who said that one of his parishioners actually had told him the statistics for his disease. He had pancreas cancer with a Whipple. He had a 5% chance of being cured. And the rabbi's response was, "What a schlemiel who would tell me that," but he felt really badly for the other 95% of the patients.
It's interesting. I mean, the way I approach that sort of disconnect has really evolved over the years.
Yes.
It used to make me extremely uncomfortable from a bioethical standpoint, the fact that a patient was clearly expressing that they had a high expectation of doing well in a situation that I know I had laid out the facts to them. And I've evolved to a position where, and the bioethical literature has sort of come around to this idea that it's really okay for people to have hope and express hope through optimism about how they're going to do, provided that you have some level of comfort that they really understand that 100 people like them are not going to necessarily do that well.
I cannot agree more to what you said, because when I normally approach this scenario of life and death, you know, can you be cured, can't you be cured, I'm pretty upfront in the sense that I say, okay, the goal of therapy here would be to prolong your life, maintain your quality of life, or you might have a curative chance. So that's something that I try to make clear very early on the first time and go from there. And then sometimes later on I go back to, you know, we talked about this and I reference our discussion. But there are situations where I do exactly what you just said. You know, sometimes you cannot provide the whole scope of things because it's almost unethical to do that. I have a 16-year-old patient with metastatic colon cancer right now. It's the youngest patient I've ever seen. Wily metastatic disease. She was on oxygen due to lung metastasis. I mean, rapidly progressive tumor. Lymph nodes from her rectum up to her supraclavicular region. So family is there. She is kind of scared. I mean, she was, again, on oxygen. When I saw her, could hardly breathe. Has a bleeding rectal cancer, apparently not curable. So what do you say to a 16-year-old girl who you want to in some way motivate to start therapy because, I mean, she's really sick from the tumor. A lot of patients that we see are not necessarily sick from their tumor. So in this situation, response mattered because she needed to get off oxygen. She needed to have some quality of life. She wanted to go back to school. She wanted to play and all these things. So I did not address this issue. At least I said it's serious. But I did not really give them the full scope of things. You know, this is going to be a non-curable situation in the sense that you can be happy if you survive 3 years.
Alan, what about sort of just taking cues from the patient? Like, you know, do you have any questions?
Right.
Let them guide you in terms of what to say.
I think for all of us at university practices, a lot of times we'll see patients midway in the course of their disease, and we don't know what they've heard. This is the first time we're seeing them. So I certainly teach the fellows, and what we do is we say, what do you understand about your disease? That's the first question I'll ask a patient. Some patients will just look at you blank, and either they've never heard it or have never processed it, and other patients will just lay it right out. To me, that gives me, you know, a place to start. But I agree with Neil. It's really difficult in the first sitting. You may only get one sitting with some of these patients to explore that, to cover the options. I find, unfortunately, that many practitioners in the community who are on the front lines and perhaps more on the spot than the academic oncologist who may be a consultant and are not entirely forthcoming with a lot of the information, or the patients aren't ready to hear it. And so I think that it is really tough. And one of the things you dare not do is lose the patient in the middle of your visit, because then they don't hear anything else that you say.
Let's get into more sort of the clinical decision in this situation in terms of where we are right now with metastatic disease.
In terms of non-protocol options in this situation, the first option is, would you go back on FOLFOX in combination with bevacizumab? Given that she had not had a tremendous amount of toxicity from it and there was a 2-year disease-free interval. Another option would be to use irinotecan 5-FU and bevacizumab, given that she'd not had irinotecan before. And those would be what I would consider to be the two standard options at that point in time. Certainly, she had not had irinotecan, she had not had an antibody against the epidermal growth factor receptor. So those were drugs on the table, but in taking a sequential approach, I thought it made the most sense to offer chemotherapy plus bevacizumab at that point.
Now, you mentioned you kind of thought it might be possible to convert her to surgically curable.
As I said that, I was sort of looking at Axel, and I could see in his eyes the emotion. She's got kids like mine, and it's one of those things where, on paper, if I'm looking at this in a conference, I'm thinking, there's no way, but with the patient in front of you...
Well, let me ask you something, because actually our education group's about to put together a web product, a pilot web product. It's kind of like a project that was done in the past called OncoSurge, mm-hmm. where you put in the location mm-hmm. and number of the tumors, and pretty much it comes back and says, no way, it's going to be curable. It's curable now, and it's in between. Now, if you put her numbers in there, her tumor size, et cetera, what would it spit out if you asked 20 experts?
Very, very unlikely that it would ever be resectable for cure.
So she'd be eligible for your study, Alan?
Sounds like it, depending on the details.
But could you review what that's looking at?
Right, so that's CLGB SWOG 80405. The chemotherapy is up to the physician and the patient, so it's either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, and it's a 3-arm randomization to cetuximab, cetuximab, bevacizumab, or bevacizumab. And so patients who've had FOLFOX adjuvant more than a year earlier would be eligible. The decision would be whether to resume FOLFOX as a backbone or go to FOLFIRI.
So would a trial like that be something you'd consider for a patient like this? Yeah,
absolutely. We also are currently conducting a study through the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, which is a large phase 2 study, ECOG 4203, which is taking the first step towards exploring whether thymidylate synthase expression by immunohistochemistry can help select those patients who are least likely to benefit from 5-fluorouracil-based therapy. And that study actually assigns half the patients who have high levels of TS in their tumor to get a regimen without 5-FU. So half of those patients will get irinotecan, oxaliplatin, and bevacizumab as their initial therapy.
I mean, would you consider that for a patient like this?
Absolutely.
I got to say, Axel, if I thought about being this patient, I mean, I don't see much. Maybe I'm missing something. Is there an opportunity here for some great response that this woman might, or is it more adding to science?
Well, great response. And
I mean, does it offer anything that, in terms of the opportunity for response or anti-tumor effect that she couldn't get off
study?
Sure,
the goal of each of these programs that we've just described is to improve upon the standard. In Allen's study, the improvement is a combination of 2 antibodies rather than 1. And in ECOG 4203, the goal is to improve outcome by sparing patients who would be resistant to 5-FU from getting 5-FU and give them other drugs first. The other sort of off-study option is a kitchen sinkish type option with multiple antibodies or irinotecan, oxaliplatin, and 5-FU.
So a patient like this says to you, doc, I'm 42 years old. I'll pay for whatever the insurance doesn't pay. You tell me, what's the best possibility? What kind of kitchen sink? Can you give me 2 or 3 things? How would you respond?
I mean, kitchen sink versus, let's say, sequential therapies of doublets or plus biologic agent, I don't think that we truly know exactly who would benefit from a kitchen sink approach. I mean, there are data coming out of Italy and now from the Netherlands using, let's say, all 3 active chemotherapy agents, fluoropyrimidine, 5-FU or capecitabine, irinotecan, oxaliplatin, in combination with bevacizumab, cetuximab even. So that's really the kitchen sink. I personally would think that this is only justified in patients where we're shooting for a clear response in order to make these tumors resectable for surgical intervention. Because otherwise, if we're talking about combining all these agents, we have to take into account potential toxicities, potential kind of early dropouts, and you'd really have no justification to really go for any kind of sequential therapy approach because you already used up a lot of these agents. So if the goal of therapy is time and quality of life and not a cure, and I think this is one of the critical decisions that we have to make quite early on and discuss with our patients, then a sequential approach is probably better because it kind of takes into account quality of life.
Bottom line is, what do you think your recommendation would be to this patient?
I mean, in this patient, if off study, and I trust Neil's judgment that this is a non-curable situation, even with a loving eye of a physician, then I would say, okay, use a chemotherapy doublet plus one biologic, and the standard of care right now would be either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab. In this situation, my treatment decision would have been FOLFIRI bevacizumab because of the prior adjuvant therapy, and FOLFIRI bevacizumab is one of the standards of care.
Alan? Yeah.
I agree. I think you're getting the issue of the study and why would you put a patient on a study who probably isn't curable no matter how robust the response. I think it remains to be seen if one arm or another might be superior, not just in making patients resectable, but in getting durable responses, for example. And I think when you treat patients, we don't treat to the median. We know what the median is, but you're looking for the outlier who gets a spectacular response. And that's why I would also have put the patient on study, or if not, given probably FOLFIRI Bev.
So I want to get on to some of the other cases, but I want to give you a chance to talk about it. Yeah,
just one other point. When I saw this patient, we didn't have the data on a sort of FOLFIRINOX regimen, which exists today. And, you know, I can imagine the scenario in a patient like this where there's a glimmer of possibility that if you had an amazing response quickly, that the patient could be resected with curative intent. And that might be the type of person who I would at least put on the table a short burst of three cytotoxics together. With Bev, with the idea that we're going to do this for one cycle, and if this stuff doesn't melt away, we're going to cut back and put you on something that is more reasonable in a longitudinal way.
Yeah, I mean, I can see things emerging in some ways when we talk about, let's say, biomarker-driven treatment decisions. We're at the verge of, I mean, in 2008, we will see this happen. We'll get more information on the usefulness of KRAS, you know, as a selection marker for or against actually certain treatment approaches. And keeping in mind that patients with tumors that have mutated KRAS probably do not have a great benefit from EGF receptor antibodies. These data are not definitive yet, but they are emerging. And by the time...
What do we know right now?
What do we know right now? Right now we know from a last-line single-agent trial, kind of a really proof-of-principle analysis, that panitumumab, which is a human antibody against EGF receptor, a target on tumor cells, which was compared against best supportive care in a phase 3 setting, that patients who had tumors carrying KRAS mutation, which is a downstream effector of the signal transduction cascade from EGF receptor, patients who had activated, meaning mutated KRAS tumors, did not have any benefit from panitumumab in terms of response rate or delaying tumor progression. So these data now have to be corroborated by looking at combination therapies, earlier lines of therapies. Does this hold up for cetuximab? We have little bits of information in smaller trials, phase 2 trials, retrospective analysis, that so far really hold up for cetuximab in combination with chemotherapy. So we're going to see more data coming out very soon. If I had to bet on anything, I would say that this will influence our treatment decisions.
Alan, are these data that are coming out right now on KRAS affecting the way you're looking at your trial?
Well, they're leading us to take an interim analysis of our trial. Hmm. We have almost 1,100 patients, and we have tissue blocks on about 900, and we're going to be looking at KRAS in those 900. It's quite a challenge because we need to correlate it with outcomes, and the outcomes aren't sort of in studies, you sort of worry about what data you have for outcomes until you've cleaned the data. But we're going to take a look. If it's a really robust difference, and it may not be. So it may be that when you take combination therapy and add an agent, an EGFR inhibitor, that even if the KRAS mutational status is very important, it still may not trump the effectiveness of the chemotherapy. So it may not come out. But we're going to look, because obviously if it really is dramatically predictive in the first-line setting, we would need to revisit the study design.
That's really exciting. How long do you think it's going to take to get it done?
Well, it'll take 4 to 6 months probably. This is an onerous task, and not the least of which is I have to go and look at, you know, help clean the data. Our goal is to do it in 4 to 6 months.
Are there any other trials out there where this is being done that, you know, might be...
Well, actually, Randy Hecht is going to present data on Sunday, an analysis of the PACE trial with this data, and the Crystal and Opus, I think. In any case, a couple of the cetuximab trials also have data that either I've seen or, you know, some of us have seen or we know about that sort of informs it.
Well, for sure this program is going out after Sunday. Can you say what the PACE trial showed?
I don't know the data well enough. I mean, I've seen it.
But I've seen the data. I have the slides.
Maybe you're comfortable talking about it because I haven't really studied it to comment.
Does it show, Axel?
The PACE trial actually had two components. One was an oxaliplatin-based component. One was an irinotecan-based component. And the irinotecan-based data, including KRAS, will be presented here. So this was now a phase 2 trial, 200 patients. Randomization, irinotecan, 5-FU, sulfonylurea, plus bevacizumab, a standard of care, plus minus panitumumab in first-line therapy. Primary endpoint, progression-free survival, whatever. So for our purpose right now, in terms of responses, and this is probably the easiest to assess as comparison in terms of activity, how active is panitumumab, this antibody against EGF receptor antigen, in patients with KRAS wild-type and mutated tumors. In patients who had KRAS mutated tumors, there was none benefit at all in terms of higher response rate for panitumumab in combination with FOLFIRI bevacizumab. In contrast, patients who had wild-type KRAS tumors, the response rate was higher when panitumumab was added to chemotherapy plus bevacizumab, to irinotecan plus bevacizumab.
Do we know anything about time to progression?
No, we don't. They're not going to present the data.
I would be a little cautious, as I understand it, it's an analysis of just the first 115 patients or so.
It's actually almost 200 patients.
I think that unless you've seen new data, because in any case, it also is, I think, investigator-assessed response.
Correct.
As opposed to
Correct.
Centrally adjudicated. And it's
actually
not blinded because you know who got panitumumab.
I mean, they present both. They present the investigator-adjudicated and the central review.
What fraction of patients have the KRAS mutation?
KRAS mutation, about 40-45%.
So you'd be sort of bringing the denominator down by around half or so.
Well, 60% of the patients would still stay on the study.
The caveat that I have here, the problem is, and that's why a little bit more problematic, is patients who have KRAS mutated tumors have a poor prognosis to begin with.
Right.
So we're talking about this link between prognostic and
predictive
marker, which always makes, you know, analysis of clinical trial data very difficult because you have overlying effects. Patients do poorer, and of course, they might not benefit from one treatment option. That's going to be critical, in especially analysis in your trials, you know, what's to dissect that out. It's
absolutely.
You know, not that easy.
The implications of these findings go well beyond whether or not you should use cetuximab or panitumumab.
Correct.
They have huge implications for how we think about what is an option for frontline therapy, what is an option for second-line therapy. Because suddenly, if you're doubling the benefit from cetuximab, suddenly, cetuximab may be looking like an appropriate earlier phase drug in therapy.
And we already have some pretty encouraging first-line data with cetuximab.
And then if you enrich the population further, you know, that's...
What do we know right now? What data have we seen so far in terms of cetuximab first-line?
Well, you've got Crystal and you've got MY80203, which incrementally 10-15% response rate, give or take.
Any way to indirectly compare that to the Bev studies?
Well, my study is directly comparing 80405.
Right, I'm talking about in terms of existing data.
They look to be in parallel, but I think it's very hard
to do that. On the other hand, the Crystal study, which looked at the addition of cetuximab to FOLFIRI as frontline therapy had pretty underwhelming results when one looks at the whole population.
PFS,
I mean, the hazard ratio showed, I think, a 15% improvement in the likelihood that you're going to progress at any point in time, which is really not very much.
So how did this woman end up getting treated?
This woman ended up doing FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab as her frontline metastatic treatment because she had had oxaliplatin before. And my experience is that even in somebody who hasn't had a lot of toxicity, neurotoxicity from oxaliplatin, that within a few cycles, your nerves remember what they've seen before and you run into trouble pretty early on.
So what happened with her?
She had a period of stable disease, but not an anti-tumor response, and never accomplished a response that would allow her to be resected for cure.
What happened?
So ultimately, she succumbed to metastatic colon cancer.
What was the sequence of treatments that she got?
The sequence of treatments, looking back on this, I believe FOLFIRI and bevacizumab, irinotecan, cetuximab. I think she went back and got FOLFOX at a certain point. And maybe one phase one study.
Let's talk about trying to get a case for each one of you. Alan?
So I have a 80-year-old woman who had a little bit of rectal bleeding, goes to a laparoscopic right hemicolectomy for a colon cancer, and I'm not making this up, has a nearly obstructing but not obstructing tumor and 0 of 11 lymph nodes involved with cancer.
So the 0 of 11.
And every bit of 80, but no comorbidities to speak of. And this was, of course, with tech-savvy daughters who accompanied her into the consultation, the issue of whether to give adjuvant therapy, and if so, what adjuvant therapy to give.
Did you have your pathologist try to find more nodes?
Well, it wasn't my pathologist. It was done at the community, and we did. We called the pathology department, and they basically either didn't want to or couldn't find the specimen, or didn't find any extra nodes. So we were left with 0 of 11.
Can you talk a little more about the woman, her daughters, and kind of what their expectations / hopes were?
Right. So this was an old country Italian woman who wanted me to tell her what to do. Wasn't interested in a lot of discussion. Just, do I need chemotherapy, was her question. In contrast to the daughters, who wanted to know every bit of the literature. And Dr. Vinok, you're telling me that 11 nodes or 12 nodes really makes a difference? And so is a very passive mom who kept looking to her kids to tell her what to do. It was quite difficult for me because my practice is to really inform, and especially when I think there's not a right or a wrong answer, my practice is to lay it out and let the patient decide. The patient ultimately wasn't happy with that because she wanted me to decide.
Neil and Axel are co-authors on a poster here at the ASCO GI meeting where we asked 150 oncologists, we gave them 5 scenarios. Yeah, there's the poster. We gave them 5 scenarios, adjuvant scenarios. And first we said, okay, how do you treat patients like this? And then, and this is an online survey, so they couldn't go back and change their first answers. And then we said, okay, you're in this situation as a patient. How would you want to be treated? I'm curious, I'm sure the patient didn't ask you, but did the daughter say to you, Doc, what would you do if it were you or if it were your grandmother?
Yeah, or my mother
mother.
This case.
Not your wife.
Not my wife. I said it's a matter of philosophy.
Did they ask you?
They did.
Really?
And I said it's a matter of philosophy rather than medical science. I said, if you estimate that the benefit is a couple of percent with treatment and there's a risk of major toxicities, it's a matter of what your expectancy is and how you would look at the odds. I made the point that somebody who really is going to be an aggressive person wouldn't even debate about taking the therapy, and yet somebody more conservative would not take the therapy at all. I'm often asked that, and I think most of us try to use that in a gray area case as, at least internally, the helping to make the decision. What would I do or what would my wife do? But you can't really, you don't know what the life experience of the person across the room from you is, and it's very tough to do that. So here, this patient really didn't qualify for a study, was elderly, although I make it a point of arguing that we don't do elderly patients a favor by under-treating them. She had sort of high-risk features, but were they high enough risk to tip these scales? And I'd be interested in what Drs. Maripol and Grothy would have done or how they would have leaned.
Neil,
so are you defining her quasi-high-risk feature as being 11 nodes?
Correct. She radiographically had near obstruction, but not obstruction. So her high-risk feature was 11 nodes.
Okay, because when studies have looked at obstruction as a poor prognostic indicator or a feature of high risk, those are people who present with, you know, frank bowel obstruction or have clear radiographic evidence of a bowel obstruction emergency operation. And it sounds like this lady had no symptoms. She had a laparoscopic
She had a CT of the abdomen that looked like an obstruction, but she was asymptomatic.
It's a symptom that counts.
Right. Also, the issue is the number of nodes. You know, the adjuvant one-line model actually uses 10 nodes. I'm not sure where he got that.
So there were a number of studies suggesting that lymph nodes are probably a continuous variable, although when they're presented in these publications, they are stratified and grouped by number of nodes. And there had been this acceptance of this notion for actually quality assurance purposes that 12 lymph nodes is a good cutoff and a goal one should aspire to, and that those people with less than 12 ought to be considered at least in some way high risk. So there were two issues for me regarding this in general, and then additional ones for this patient. In general, it's not dichotomous, less than 12, more than 12. So 11 is pretty close to 12. So a person with 11 nodes is not the same as somebody who had no nodes. That's number one. Number two, there is a contrarian view that was raised in a paper published in the Journal of the American Medical Association within the past 6 months using a large administrative data set suggesting that number of lymph nodes in stage 2 colon cancer, in fact, does not confer increased risk.
Although that was from University of Wisconsin, what I thought that publication said more was that as a marker of quality and outcome, centers that reported fewer nodes had exactly the same outcomes as centers who had more nodes.
Yep.
So in any case, I think as a quality outcome measurement, it really didn't hold up.
I agree.
So let's get down to the nitty-gritty. I have written down here my predictions about what the three of you are going to say based on my guesses knowing you. Okay? So I'm going to show you, but first I'm going to ask you. Neil, bottom line, these daughters are saying, what would you do if you were you? The woman's saying, doctor, tell me what to do. What do you say?
I would liberate the patient and tell her I'm cool with no adjuvant therapy.
Axel.
I would agree.
We're unanimous.
I got the two of you down for fluoropyrimidines alone, Axel and Alan. How about if she were 70?
Yeah.
Is
no,
that the
actually,
issue here,
the reason for me, I look at it mechanistically. This woman had a big tumor in the right colon. And the way I look at it is she'd never had a screening colonoscopy. She had no use for doctors. The way I look at it is if you get a primary tumor that can grow to be 5-6 centimeters, nearly obstructing without any symptoms and still be node negative, that it's a biologically inept tumor. And that doesn't mean I'm right, but that's my bias for
that's
how
it's.
So would you have said the same thing if she were 70?
I would have. Because
60?
Well, I think as you get younger, I would have put the onus more on the patient, perhaps.
Okay, but she's still the same woman.
But,
she's
but
still saying what to
I
do.
Was
she's
still,
60.
I would say I was 60-40 in terms of how I felt. I think younger she was, I probably would have leaned a little bit more favorably towards chemotherapy. However, I still think that the mechanism of metastases are such that I looked at that and thought this is an indolent tumor.
Interesting.
And this is a patient who I don't think is going to relapse.
Yeah.
Axel?
First of all, when you look at the MOSAIC trial, which we base a lot of our recommendations on in terms of definition of high-risk stage 2 and stage 3, and we all switched to FOLFOX, and they excluded patients over the age of 75. And if you really want to play it by the books, you don't have any data on a patient with a kind of borderline high-risk situation who's over 80. At all.
For Oxali.
For Oxaplan. So about any therapy, and I agree, I mean, this is just real life, that the younger the patients get, the more in life risk they have to lose in some ways. It's just a matter of adjustments and assessments that we make all along. The point that Alan raised in terms of looking at the biology is actually something that is very difficult to quantify, measure, whatever, and put in clinical trials, and not even retrospective analysis, but it's exactly the same gut feeling that I have. If I see it, there is a large tumor, and it's only able to produce a localized phenomenon stage 2 cancer without any evidence of spread, This is very similar to a situation where, say, a patient had, let's say, a tumor 10 years ago and has a recurrence, or 5 years ago, and has a recurrence with a solitary liver metastasis, which I think can be easily chopped out, compared to a patient where presents with synchronous metastasis. And we can actually, we should probably start with chemotherapy, even in a resectable situation, because we have no information about the biology of the disease.
So in general, right now, if you see a 55-year-old, completely healthy person, who has stage 2 disease and no high risk factors, what's that patient, Neil, likely to have as a non-protocol therapy in your practice?
It's probably a 50-50 split between getting fluoropyrimidine or nothing.
Alan?
If they're not a study patient, I would agree. I would use capecitabine alone or not at all, depending on other issues.
Incidentally, what was the fluoropyrimidine you would usually use in this situation?
Capecitabine.
How about you, Axel?
You know, for me, it would be, I sometimes sit down with patients, look at adjuvant online, print it out. It's actually a very nice tool to look at actual potential benefits. And I would actually not even exclude oxaliplatin-based therapy.
Well, the thing that's interesting is in our poster, when we asked the doctors, not just about themselves, but about patients, because we didn't see much difference in this from my point of view, and I think it was certainly not a dramatic difference. I mean, what people recommended and what they did.
I think there are a subset of patients who get benefit and a subset who don't. That's why I think E5202 as an example is incredibly important, because I think there are two populations.
And of course, just to refresh people's memory, that's looking in terms of
that
markers.
That risk stratifies by deletion in 18q and microsatellite status. And it may not be the right stratifications, and there may be better tools coming along. Genomic Health has another presentation tomorrow,
right,
which is really, I think, very impressive. But to me, there are populations that would be appropriately treated and others who you should leave alone.
Axel?
I mean, stage 2 is known to be a gray zone, and it just, the poster doesn't reflect our internal inconsistencies. And again, this is an area where tests like Genomic Health or any biomarker or whatever, where we can get more information about the patient and the tumor, would be extremely helpful and very well received, because, again, you can probably poll 1,000 different physicians and you would never get consistent answers, even in larger sample sizes.
And Neil, you know, in breast cancer, it's been amazing how things have changed in terms of lower-risk patients with the Oncotype. It's like a whole new world. I mean, even though it's not perfect, but now there's something, you know, at least you have some basis to make some decisions and some better numbers. It kind of reminded me a little bit what you're saying about KRAS. You get better numbers to work with.
Yeah, and also within the past year, there have been two important pieces of data to inform the decisions about stage 2 adjuvant therapy. One is the updated data from Mosaic, which clearly demonstrate, in my view, that for patients who do not have high-risk features, there's absolutely no benefit from the addition of oxaliplatin.
Do you think was there the power to really answer that question?
You know, I think it wasn't powered to answer that question in particular. However, the fact that there's absolutely no difference, I'm convinced of that finding.
For low-risk stage 2, I agree.
For patients without increased risk.
I think a lot of people have confused that with the idea of, quote, there's no benefit to adjuvant therapy.
No, this is FOLFOX versus 5-FU.
I'm saying, I think the message has gotten confused a little bit in the community.
Right, and then the other piece of data that recently came out are from the QUASAR study, which is just published in December in The Lancet, showing that for patients with stage 2 disease where the physician felt there was uncertainty about whether to treat, that giving a 5-FU leucovorin regimen improved survival by a few percent compared to those that didn't get adjuvant therapy. Again, it begs the question of high-risk clinical features versus low-risk clinical features, but those were patients enrolled who the physician felt had some uncertainty about what to do.
Want to present your case, Axel?
Yeah, so I go into the older arena again, 76-year-old male patient, who was actually widowed just about half a year ago and lived alone by himself, had very limited contact to his family. He had two daughters and one son who really very rarely looked after him. So he gradually deteriorated. No one noticed. And eventually someone actually visited him. And so he was lost weight, was apparently jaundiced, and really looked sick. And he had a very hard belly. So they brought him to the ER at Mayo Clinic, and they saw a huge liver reaching into the pelvis and clear below the umbilicus, and did a CT scan and saw liver metastases all over and biopsy, kind of first diagnosed with adenocarcinoma of unknown primary, and sent to medical oncology more or less on the way out. And I saw him in my clinic, an outpatient. I was kind of borderline looking at this patient. Is really someone who should be an outpatient or should he be admitted? His bilirubin was 12. His LDH, which we did, was about 2,000. And so he was presented to me as unknown primary, whatever there is. And interestingly, he had been seen by, I think, 5 different doctors. No one had performed a rectal exam. This patient had repeated bleed, rectal bleeds and whatever. So to make a long story short, rectal exam showed there was an almost obstructing tumor. You can see it was very narrow. It was bleeding, not too much. It was slightly anemic, but not really anemic.
He had obstructive symptoms?
And, you know, if you ask him, so he had this intermittent change between constipation and diarrhea, which we see sometimes with low-lying rectal cancers. And so the question was for me, and the family was there, and everyone, of course, all of a sudden concerned. So
comorbidities?
No, nothing really. I mean,
so he'd been functional and fine?
You know, the interesting thing is when I said, you know, he deteriorated, this actually happened quite relatively what I saw in within a short time frame. 2 months earlier, he was still supervising as a 76-year-old road construction in Rochester.
Huh.
So apparently, I don't know what shape he was at that point, but if he was at that time, at least functional. So for me, the decision was, at first, should we treat at all? I mean, this was a patient performance status 3 to 4. I mean, really, when you high bilirubin, liver function, LFTs were 3 digits range, LDH was high.
So, Alan, real quick, your thoughts?
Well, tough call. I think colon cancer can be so sensitive to chemotherapy that my instinct would be to treat the patient. I think I probably would have done either a diverting ostomy or not, depending on the imminent stricture or blockage, and I'd probably offer something like Folfox or something like that.
I mean,
you're not going to cure the patient. I would argue that Bev may make the difference between a robust response and a good response, but I don't think, you know, he's got a rectal mass that's bleeding a bit. He's 80. I mean, I would probably start with Folfox, and if you made any ground up, then maybe get a little tougher later on.
Neil?
I explained to a patient like this that this is a bad situation, and then try and elicit what his short-term goals are.
Right.
And, you know, to use the football analogy, since Super Bowl Sunday is coming up on us, do we want to throw the Hail Mary pass here? And to use another analogy at the same time and mix them, does he want the potential to go down in flames? And that said, I then consider from a pharmacology standpoint, what treatment is feasible in this situation. And as Alan suggested, Folfox and bevacizumab would be acceptable therapies in somebody with liver failure. And so I have offered and treated patients who come in with hyperbilirubinemia because of disease with this regimen. And Axel wouldn't be presenting this had he not had a wild success.
Okay,
so I'm interested in hearing what happened.
It's actually interesting because my first discussion was along those lines. What are the goals that this patient would have? And, you know, he was actually depressed. He lived alone, widowed. And at first he said, you know, I don't really know whether it's worth it. And then I actually made it at kind of, and he said, so what are we talking about here? I said, you know, the way this tumor is progressing right now and the shape you're in, this is a matter of weeks and not months. That's the estimate I gave him. I said, no, that's short. And I said, so along those lines, if we have a good response, we might. I didn't talk about, you know, the two-year thing that we normally. I said, you know, if you were around in a year from now, that's achievable, and I would think that's a success. And he said, I want therapy. So that was the final decision. And, you know, we started exactly with Folfox. I did not use bevacizumab first cycle. The bleeding stopped. I was actually quite hesitant about this idea of diverting colostomy because it was really an emergency situation
right.
for those. And I didn't want to get into kind of troubles on that. So we started Folfox, saw him weekly. I saw him weekly because I really wanted to make sure that he doesn't kind of have anything from tumor lysis to whatever kidney failure or anything there. And bleeding stopped almost immediately. He felt better. His bilirubin really dropped significantly. I added bevacizumab from the second cycle on. I didn't even implant a portocatheter. We didn't have time to do that. He had a PICC line, you know, because actually I also wasn't sure, is it worthwhile implanting a portocatheter device, because we might just only do one cycle, one application of Fofox. I also omitted bolus 5-FU. I didn't want to run into any problems. And it's very interestingly, after three cycles, actually after four cycles, his liver was not palpable anymore. This is one of the most dramatic responses I've seen. I mean, he was actually, again, going back on construction, supervising road construction, to kind of follow up on that.
He went back to work?
He went back to kind of doing his living.
A lot of potholes in the highways in Rochester.
After winter, yeah. So he went back to work. I mean,
CEA?
CEA normalized, actually.
How high was it?
It was in the range of 500. So not as high as, I mean, I've seen higher CAs, his LDH normalized. To be really honest, I mean, he benefited a lot from that, but it didn't sustain long. He had problems with toxicities in the end, even in spite of the leading bolus 5-FU.
What kind of toxicity?
He had some neutropenia, some infectious complications. He fell at home, some family issues that family wasn't able to provide kind of better care for him. So he deteriorated again. We had to hospitalize him. He had diarrhea, all these issues. So in the end, about 9 months later, his tumor was controlled as long as we kind of kept therapy around. 9 months later, he said, you know, I think that's it. We've done our share. Mm-hmm. We've done exactly what we wanted to do, and you've given me some time. So we stopped therapy, and he died almost exactly 1 year after he started therapy. And so in the end, family came back to me and said, you know, we remember you talked to him, and in good case scenario, you give him 1 year, and that's exactly what you did. So in the end, everyone was happy. Having said that, you know, it's 1 year is not a lot, but this patient would have had a couple of, perhaps 2 weeks without treatment.
Were there any things that happened during that year that were particularly important to him? You know, people talk about going to weddings and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, his thing was he worked on a bench that he built in his backyard. He wasn't really too concerned about his family or whatever happened there, but he built this bench. And he was so happy. He showed me pictures of it later. And this is his project while he was getting chemotherapy. And he built the bench.
You know, my case was going to be similar, but a 42-year-old nurse who had two young children who actually presented with a disease that defied imagination, who had rapidly progressive disease and actually presented with lactic acidosis, which I've never seen before in colon cancer. In fact, I was so doubtful of it, she had a primary colon, and I asked them to re-biopsy the liver lesions to make sure there wasn't a small cell component. This is how aggressive it was. I just treated her with Folfox. She had a bilirubin of 5. She had an ongoing acidosis. And I was afraid if she had any toxicities whatsoever, that was going to be that. This is just a few months ago. And she had actually treated her at 10 days. So we treated her and treated her again at 10 days. It was like a kinetic failure of colon cancer. And at least now, after four cycles, her CEA went from 10,000 to 3,000. She's got out of the hospital. We treated her in the hospital because she had a lactic acidosis requiring bicarb drip.
Who was it from, the lactic acidosis?
Well, we assume it may be overwhelming liver involvement, but we speculate that she may have some inborn error of metabolism or some inherent kidney defect that explained it, because I've just never seen it before. But it resolved, so it clearly had something to do with the cancer.
And again, were there things that happened that have happened these last few months?
Well, again, she's only 2 months into it, but she's a nurse. She gets it entirely, but she's just savoring every moment she has with her young children. She went to Lake Tahoe last week. Her kids had never seen the snow, so she took her kids to the snow. So I agree with Axel. I mean, this is a lady who's got not a good prognosis. We're not going to kid ourselves that this response is going to be durable. But, you know, an example where you give them a chance to fill out some of their wish list.
Yeah, perhaps the most memorable exchange along the lines of the wish list that I ever had with a patient was a woman in her early 40s I took care of who died from rectal cancer that was metastatic. And what she wanted to live for, she expressed in this way to me. She said, I have a 15-year-old son, and he's not yet the man that I know he can be. And she savored driving him to his activities. She said that she viewed chauffeuring him around to his friends and to different activities in a completely different way. It was no longer a chore, but it was an opportunity for her to have important conversations with important time with him. And to this day, I almost cry every time I think of this, because she wanted to do what she could to make him the man he was going to be.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we talk about this few percent thing. Actually, I think I may have mentioned to you, I interviewed Dan Sargent and asked him about the work that we'd done, you know, looking at this. And he told me that he had Hodgkin's and got chemo radiation, as you probably know, Axel, having been his colleague. I said, well, what do you think about this 1%, you know, kind of thing? And he said, well, if I were single, no way would I get treated for 1%. But I'm looking at my kids right now. And I don't know, how often, Alan, do you see that that's a driving motivation for people?
Well, it sure would be for me.
It would be for me, too.
So I think there's no connection like your kids. I think for most people, I believe, when they take treatment that's gray area, are driven more by concerns of others around them than they are by their own interests. In fact, I think a lot of patients who take treatment do it against their better judgment because they think they have some work left to be done.
I was thinking about your rabbi, too, in terms of what he said. I wonder if he was trying to make other people comfortable.
Well, he was amazing. He strolled the infusion center regularly and chatted to people, and he succumbed to the disease like the majority of patients do. But basically, his message was, you're you and do what you need to do for yourself. So, and I think as you get older, I agree with Neil, I think we all sort of drift a little bit in the purity, in the sort of academic sense, and you realize that these decisions are much more complex than the academics would paint them.